Hello, this is Alex Gonsalves of Tuga Scouts, and you are listening to the Cellar Sound Podcast.
Simoes, bending one for Torres. Eusebio. Oh, my word! Have you ever seen anything like that?
Bem jogado por Simão. A passar por dois adversários, Simão. A tentar obter o golo, Figo. E a bola, golo! O golo de Figo!
Rui Costa vai, Rui Costa vai, acreditou. Vai tirar para o golo, atira o golo!
Chuta, chuta, chutou! Gol!
And we welcome you to episode number 41 of the Seleção Podcast, a proud partner of Portugal.net. My name is Danny Pinto. I am your host. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode as... just a pretty easy, not dramatic, run-of-the-mill 7 points and sitting on top of Group A of World Cup qualifying for this last song. I would say nothing really much to talk about. This won't be a long discussion. This will probably be the shortest episode we have. No, I doubt that very much. A lot to unravel, a lot to uncover here from these past three matches as, yes, the Seleção does sit atop their group with 7 points, two victories, and a draw. Ronaldo does score goal number 103, so he inches ever closer to the scoring record for international football on the men's side. But not all draws, not all victories are created equal. Not a very easy and pleasing to watch three matches were these. For us as fans to watch, and I'm sure for the players to play in, and for Fernando Santos to manage in. But we will get all of it covered here on episode number 41 of the Seleção Podcast with our guest Alex Gonçalves of TugaScout.com. He was kind enough to spend some time with us, and we covered it all from these last three matches. So I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. We will actually get to the interview here in just a few moments. We just want to get a bit of the business out of the way before we get to it. Again, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at SeleçãoPod, Facebook.com/SeleçãoPod. Email the show, SeleçãoPod@gmail.com. And, of course, the redesigned SeleçãoPod.com website. Really appreciate the feedback you guys have given us so far on the site. Hope you guys are liking the changes to the site. And again, any ideas or any thoughts on the website, go ahead and send it to me, whether it's on social media, through the website, or via email. So greatly appreciate everyone's feedback on that. Also would appreciate you guys, if you guys have not already, give us a 5-star rating and a kind word or two via Apple Podcasts. If you're subscribing elsewhere on Spotify, Google Play, obviously, muito obrigado. Thank you so much for the support. And just make sure you guys are spreading the word as best you can, because any kind of positive feedback that we can get, especially on those podcasting platforms, makes our show more visible to those who may not know that this podcast exists. And we want to make sure that we can get as many people listening to us and being a part of this brand, for lack of a better term, as possible. So got all that out of the way. Greatly appreciate you guys tuning in. And I don't want to wait any further, because we had a great conversation here with Alex Gonçalves about the last three World Cup qualifiers and a whole lot of other topics that we've seen on social media the last few days. So without further ado, here is Alex Gonçalves of TugaScout.com right here on episode number 41 of the Seleção Podcast. So we have a lot to cover here on episode number 41 of the Seleção Podcast. Again, we thank you guys for always coming to this pod and getting your Seleção fix, and a gentleman who is returning to the show, and we're excited to have him back this time to talk about the Seleção, because we had him during the pandemic when things were a little I guess on pause, for lack of a better term, but it's good to have Alex Gonçalves of Tuga Scout back with us here on the Slesson podcast for episode number 41. Alex, again, great to have you back on. And how have you been?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me again. It's great to be back on, you know. Feeling pretty good. Happy with how Portugal did overall. I think probably happier than some people, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, I mean, I would you know, probably categorize the 7 points in a first place showing after three matches as pretty ho hum. I mean, I don't think anything. This will probably be a very short interview. Nothing really going on, right?
Yeah. I guess so.
Well, we'll get right into it here. I had put out a poll after the third match here, and I had put it out to the followers of the pod on Twitter, and I had said if you were to give, or if you didn't know, I should say, how the Slesson played in these first three matches, would you have taken 7 points and sitting atop the group, without knowing how the 7 points came about? And we put out the poll. 70%, almost 71%, said they would have taken the 7 points and sitting atop of first. About 30%, almost 30%, said no. I think Tom Kundert said it perfectly. The expectations here are so high with this group of players that, you know, it has to be 9 points. It has to be 3-4-0. It always has to be a dominating performance. Obviously, that's not realistic, and that is not the trademark of a Fernand Sanchez-led team. But with all the talent on the squad, why do you think that it sometimes is as difficult to play a nice style and an aesthetically pleasing style of football for this group of players led by Fernand Sanchez?
Well, I mean, it goes beyond Fernand Sanchez, I think, though, because it seems to be in Portugal's DNA, really, to make it difficult for themselves. You know, we've seen over the years, Portugal have made a handful of qualifying. You know, we've seen the loss to Albania, of course. We've seen a draw to Liechtenstein, to Cyprus, I believe. So you know, I guess the difference this time is that actually Portugal managed to get the job done, which is the most important thing. You know, it wasn't pretty, but 7 points is a good return, and I as your poll suggests, that most people are pretty happy with that. So it's an awkward one, because I think we've seen some excellent performances with Fernando Santos in charge. Everyone, you know, harks back to the Croatia match, where Portugal were fluid, attacking with intensity. I think it's just a case of the opposition that Portugal are facing. You know, it's always difficult to face a side like Azerbaijan and Luxembourg, who you know are going to be quite defensive. They're gonna want to frustrate. This means a lot to them, these types of matches. To be able to even put up a fight is a massive achievement for them. And you know, it's been a long season for the Portugal players, more so than for the guys for Azerbaijan and Luxembourg for the most part. So I think that's kind of telling. We've seen other big nations struggle this break. Spain only drew against Greece. They nearly dropped points against Georgia. You know, we saw the Netherlands lose to Turkey. It took them 40 minutes to score against Gibraltar. We saw Croatia lose to Slovenia. So there's a lot of examples of bigger teams struggling. And I think that's kind of a consequence of the length of the season, really. I think it's been a massively intense season for so many of the top players. So I think we can just say 7 points. It wasn't particularly pretty, but job done.
Let's get to the Serbia match, because that's the match that has the most controversy and the most I would say angst as a fan of the Slesson. Obviously the 2-0 lead, then followed by giving up the two goals, one right at the beginning of the half, less than a minute into the half. They then tie the match, does Serbia, and then the goal that was robbed because there is no VAR or goal line technology in that match, where Ronaldo would have given the Slesson the victory there. In your opinion, especially in the second half, where does the blame lie in the letdown? Because, I mean, if you were to take it again, and we're going, because something is on the surface doesn't mean that the way in which it happened is acceptable. But it's a great, it's, I shouldn't say it's a great, it's a good result if you draw away and win at home. That has been the textbook way that people advance in group play. It's a draw against the rival in your group away, and that's great. But because of the way it happened, where do you see the blame lie in the way that the team responded in the second half, being up 2-0?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with the fact that the point is excellent. Oh, it's very good. It's a very good point, but the manner of it is disappointing. And, you know, in terms of blame, I guess there was an element of complacency in the second half. And I think that that's likely to come more from the players than the manager. I can't imagine Fernando Santos getting complacent. It's something you can't really say he would be at any stage. They hit very early in the second half, and I think that probably put Portugal on the back foot a little bit. It kind of unnerved them, I would have thought. But sometimes you just have to give credit to the opposition. And I mean, Serbia came out a different animal really in the second half. They played with much more intensity, much more attacking intent, and you know they got the reward for it, which they fully deserved. Portugal didn't really know how to deal with it from that point on. I think they were caught a little off guard, and I guess you could also pin that on the manager. He should have probably warned them a little bit more of that, maybe made them look to be a little bit more conservative, a little bit more cautious, but also at the same time, go for that third goal, because 2-0 is always a dangerous result, a dangerous scoreline. Although they didn't really have time because they scored so early. So it's a tough one to analyse, because that early goal, it changes the whole complexion of the game. You're going in at the break 2-0, it's looking pretty good. And that early goal, just suddenly everything's unnerved. So I think there's equal share probably among the manager and player. But more than anything, Serbia earned the points. And so I would give them the credit more than being overly critical of Portugal.
I will respectfully disagree about earning the point, because obviously Portugal was robbed of the 3 points. But I absolutely
well,
see
that's your, very true.
You're absolutely right. But I absolutely see your point. Serbia took it to the Slesson. They pressed. They put the pressure on the defense, and it showed with the results of, you know, that first goal right in the first minute of the second half. They continued to pressure the Portugal defense. Portugal really could not get anything going offensively as well. Played a little disjointed, I would say. And like you said, I think that goal changed the whole complexion of how the Slesson would play the rest of the second half. And there's only so much that Fernand Sanch can do once a game is starting and the ball is rolling, because he has to rely on the players that are on the field and obviously the substitutions that come in after. But I'm sure that it was a jolt to the system that it looked all the way up until the goal that was denied by the referee. It just seemed like it was a jolt to the system that Portugal really never recovered from.
I think you're absolutely right. I agree with everything you say. Yes. It was, you can't put too much blame on the manager, because ultimately you've got the 11 players out there who should be able to see out the game from a 2-0 leading position, regardless of any manager, really. They're good enough to be able to do that. And there's only so much control he has. But you're absolutely right as well with the VAR decision. Let's talk about that, because, or I should say the goal line technology situation, because it's a little bit farcical, let's be honest, that... there's no goal line technology to qualify for the biggest competition on the planet. You know, I expect the reasoning for that is probably because the smaller nations don't have the technology in place to be able to use it. So to make it fairer, they say that nobody uses it. But that just seems like completely flawed logic, really. I mean, I don't know how that kind of balances things out. Surely it's better to use it where you can and reduce the chances of situations like this occurring, rather than just saying it'll occur equal chance to every team. It just seems preposterous, really. But you're absolutely right that Portugal were robbed of the win. I don't think they deserved the win on the balance of play. I think a draw was the fair result. But 100%, it should have been a 3-2 win for Portugal, and they should be cruising the group right now. So it's made things complicated. And even though it wasn't fully deserved for Portugal, it should be 9 points from 9 rather than 7. So you're absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah, but I think you summed it up there perfectly. Where a draw, given, you know, outside of the controversial no goal, Given the way that Serbia came back, a draw would have been a just result, I think, for both teams. But,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things, Alex, and we're talking with Alex Gonsalves here on episode number 41 of the Slesson podcast. To me, I mean, these matches are televised, every single one of them. The technology is there. The picking and choosing of how, you know, this should be a UEFA and a FIFA responsibility to make sure that every single match has this technology, because we are in the age of technology. There is no excuse now to, and I know VAR and goal line technology, but especially VAR has been the bane of many soccer fans' existence here for the last couple of years. You know, with here in the States, we get a lot of EPL matches that, you know, it's a handball that is very very gray, and yet it's called one way one day, and it's called another way the next day. The inconsistencies of VAR have been very controversial, for sure. But with that said, when there is something as plain as day as that ball crossing the line, and there is green after the ball has crossed, so you could clearly see. I mean, there's jokes and memes about the line being moved a good 2 feet that we've seen. I think even Matic from Manchester United has put up a meme towards Bruno Fernandes, and you can clearly see the touch line now has been moved a couple of feet there. But the point of my rant here is that the technology is there. If the networks and the broadcasters and the companies who are carrying these games can show the replay, there is no excuse for UEFA, there's no excuse for FIFA and the other federations to not have this technology at their disposal for every single game of these qualifiers, because God forbid that Portugal misses out because of 2 points, they can clearly go back to that game and be like, hey, those are the 2 points that we're missing here. And they shouldn't rely on anyone bailing them out. They earned that goal, whether they earn, and you know, they earned the goal, they scored the goal, but yet because they don't have the official licensed technology from for VAR or goal line, whatever it is, they're out 2 points. And to me, that's the most frustrating part. I mean, that whole match was a bout of frustration because of how the draw happened and then how the win didn't come. But to me, there's no excuse for these federations to not have any kind of replay, an assistant referee with video replay to help them get these calls corrected.
Oh, I couldn't have put it any better, Danny. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, I don't think anybody even considered the possibility that goal line technology wasn't in play until that moment actually occurred. I think everyone just assumed that it would be, because we've had it for 4 or 5 years now. You know, it's been years. Everyone just assumed that it would be in play. So it was a painful way to lose it. We're not used to seeing that anymore. You know, that's supposed to be a thing of the past. And I couldn't agree more that it's the federations that should ensure that every nation has this in place for these matches. It doesn't make much sense to me that you would miss such an integral part of the game today that has just revolutionized the game in terms of we know when there's a goal and when there isn't. When I saw Cristiano Ronaldo complaining to the linesman, again, at that point, I wasn't aware that goal line technology wasn't in play. So I was assuming that he was being a little bit cheeky there. You know, he was complaining because he was so desperate for the goal. Of course he was. But I thought it couldn't be a goal because it would be given. And seeing the replays and then learning that of course it wasn't in play was it's beyond frustrating. It is, because these games shouldn't be decided like this. We've seen it happen in the past. Of course, there was the infamous one with England Germany that was well over the line. But again, that's supposed to be a thing of the past. We're not supposed to see these wrong decisions happen anymore. You talk about VAR. We have those kind of subjective calls with handball, for example, and that's always again, it's an element that people complain about VAR for, which is fair enough. But with these decisions, which are so black and white, they're so clear, it's bewildering. I don't really have the words to explain how ridiculous it is that it's not there. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I get if they don't want to spend the money on friendlies, and honestly, like the way football has gone about, especially on the European side. There's been less and less friendlies. So these matches mean something, whether it be Nations League, whether it be qualifying, whether it be, I mean, I'm going to assume that VAR and goal line technology is going to be in play here at the Euros beginning in June. But why? I mean, there's no reason
you never
for
know
it.
Anymore,
yeah, but there's no reason for it not to. It's you know, it's a headache upon headaches. And well, you know, I think the ranting there is, I think I'm getting it out of my system here. So we'll continue on here on episode 41 here of the Slesson podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning in again. Alex, after the Azerbaijan and the Luxembourg matches, you know, and fans have, and I mean, I consider myself a fan first. I have a podcast, but I'm not a journalist. I'm not a member of the media. I'm a fan who does a podcast. So I might fall into this as well. But, you know, these are opponents, Azerbaijan and Luxembourg, that on paper, Portugal should be putting away by a significant margin solely based on the talent that is on the Portuguese side. Fernando Santos, on the other hand, his main job when he came on in 2014, his main job was to get results, to get wins, no matter how it looks, no matter if it's ugly. Results are what drives his success. 2016 in the Euros was a prime example. No one says that was a beautiful soccer, beautiful football to watch, but no one is also giving back the trophy because it wasn't particularly pleasing to look at. Should he try to balance more of a pleasing style with the result, or is the bottom line in his world the result itself, in your opinion?
I mean, I think bottom line, it has to be the results first and foremost. I don't think anyone would trade the Euro 2016 for anything, you know. And that was not the beautiful football that we've seen of World Cup 2006, Euro 2004. We've seen Portugal play some amazing football in the past, and it's been, you know, they've been a neutral's favourite in previous years because of that that football that they played. And with Fernando Santos, we're kind of embracing a slightly different style. But ultimately, it's given us two trophies. And, you know, if we're not able to do it playing pretty, we may as well be the ugly ducklings and get the results. So long as we're getting the results, it's fine. It's a fine line, again, because, of course, if it does go wrong, then you're scrutinized even further than you would be if you were playing good football and lost. So a loss is always, you know, it's emphasized even more when we lose playing this way. Ultimately, I think we've been a little spoiled, even with Fernando Santos, because we have got used to dispatching of these kind of teams with relative ease in recent years. You know, we've seen some good thrashings. But I would also say that there aren't as many minnows in Europe as there have been in the past. And I don't think Azerbaijan and Luxembourg fall into that category anymore. I mean, we saw Azerbaijan go on and push Serbia all the way in the very next match. They only lost 2-1. They were drawing up until the 80th minute. And we saw Luxembourg beat Ireland in their first game. This isn't a particularly good Ireland side, but I think that's a good result for them away from home. It's always good to get that win. So we see a Luxembourg side with some respectable players playing at a decent level. Azerbaijan have a manager who knows how to get results and frustrate teams. I mean, of course, there are two matches that you absolutely expect Portugal to win, possibly even more comfortably than they did. But I don't think that this was ever going to be particularly easy, because they're two teams that clearly know how to annoy even the top teams. We've seen Luxembourg draw against France and Italy in recent history. We saw in the last group stage, Luxembourg were in Portugal's group and they pushed Ukraine and Serbia all the way in those two matches. So I think maybe we were just a little bit disrespectful in a sense towards the teams, expecting to brush them aside with ease, when of course they're highly motivated for this and they've proven that they can frustrate teams as well.
Yeah, it's, I think, Alex, and I think you mentioned it earlier in the interview here, I think there's two things going on. One, the bigger teams have more players playing in the bigger leagues that are playing a more truncated schedule. So there, they're just playing a lot more matches. I found it kind of odd that a World Cup that is scheduled to be played at the end of 2022 would have all of their World Cup qualifiers, at least in UEFA, all played in the calendar year of 2021. I thought having three international matches in 6 days is just bonkers. And I just don't think, given the date of the next World Cup, and given that everything is kind of truncated already, why FIFA and UEFA wouldn't work on maybe spreading these out a little bit more. I know that there are international calendars that that they have to abide by, but I think there's a lot going on there. But I also agree that there is an expectation and a spoiled aspect of it, because you know there are a lot of fans who want the trophy, don't care how they got the trophy. There's also fans who want the trophy, but it has to be won a certain way. And that's the part that I'll never understand. Call me a champion however I got there. As long as I'm not cheating, who the hell cares? But it's a tough spot for him, for Nonsense to be in, because of the amount of talent that is on display around Europe in all these leagues. And when it comes to the collaborative effort on the national side, it doesn't click. And I think a lot of it has to do with playing in so many different leagues. A lot of players don't play with each other, with the exception of Wolves and maybe Man City. But there's not a lot of guys who have that built-in cohesion, that chemistry, because they're seeing each other once every 2-3 months. And the training I think they had one training session. And also, Alex, they played three road games. They played three away games. They didn't play in Portugal at all.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's just a huge combination of things. Is he without fault and should be without criticism? Absolutely not. I think that he could be getting more out of this group based on their talent. But again, do you want the result or do you want a result with style? And ideally you'd get both, but as long as he's getting results, that should be the only thing that he's judged on.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's unfortunate, because ultimately you do have that portion of fans that are, it has to be in a certain way. And I think maybe some of them are a little bit younger as well. I think that might be a thing that it's the people that don't have the memories of 2004 and 2006, particularly, firm in their minds, because we've seen Portugal play some great football in the past with that previous golden generation, and it didn't result in anything. And that frustration after the 2004 final was beyond bearable, let's be honest. So to get it done in 2016, it didn't matter how it was done. It was ultimately to get the trophy, because I think Portugal up to that point were by far the best team to have never won anything. So I 100% agree with you. I think it's difficult to accept those people who are so adamant that it has to be won in a certain way, when ultimately very few people get to see their country win any trophy, So to do it in any way possible, in any way necessary, is ultimately the only thing that matters. And Fernando Santos's track record up to this point has been second to none. Essentially, it's been extraordinary. He probably doesn't get the credit he deserves purely because of the style of football, or the perceived style of football that he has his teams play.
Yeah, the aesthetics are not the greatest, but you can't really argue with the results since he's taken over here. But we've talked about the play. Let's talk about the actual players here. Who stood out to you in these three matches, either positively or negatively? Who in these three matches stood out to you, Alex, as either future or now present contributors to this list song, especially with the Euros coming up here in the summer? and maybe some players who maybe did themselves a bit of disservice, either their fault or not. But maybe now it could be on the outside looking in as we get closer to Euro 2020.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think there were a few positive displays individually. I think the obvious one, who needs the most praise, is Nuno Mendes, who I thought was quality down the left flank. I was a bit concerned because, of course, of his inexperience, but also the fact that he's used to playing in a back three or a back five. But he was fantastic. You know, his confidence on the ball, his decision making, and his work on the overlap and his crossing. I thought he was pretty much faultless. And so I think he's pretty much cemented himself in the Euro 2020 squad. I think that he's actually going to rival Guerreiro for a starting berth. I think he was that good. And I think that Renato Sanches also deserves a huge mention. He added a huge amount of energy to midfield. He was always looking to make something happen. He was direct, always looking forwards. And again, he made a case to be a starter at the Euros as well. Of course, it's a bit stacked in the midfield and in that attacking midfield role. But you have to say that he adds a certain dynamism to that midfield that has been lacking perhaps in the other two matches that we saw. And of course, Diogo Jota. Whose three goals got Portugal out of big trouble in terms of struggling to unlock particularly unlock Luxembourg. That header right at the end was huge, and his brace against Serbia as well, really good. Yeah, it's great to have a player that's just continually scoring, even when he doesn't particularly play amazingly or contribute hugely. Ultimately, all that matters is getting those goals, and that's what he did. In terms of the negatives, I don't think there were too many. I think, you know, Andre Silva perhaps is the main one. He didn't really have an impact versus Azerbaijan. But, you know, he didn't get much game time. So it's a little harsh to judge him on such a short space of action. But yeah, he seems to probably be on the outside looking in at this moment in time. But I would say that you could also say that that the main man, Cristiano Ronaldo, it wasn't his finest showing. Let's say he looked a little bit off his best. His free kicks were unspectacular. I think you'll agree.
Just a bit.
Some of his shooting and heading was quite wild as well. You know, that double miss, that double one-on-one miss versus Luxembourg. To make it 3-1, that is very rare. You do not see Cristiano Ronaldo mess up in those positions. You just don't. And it had to be seen to be believed. And you could put that maybe down to a bit of a lack of confidence, really, which you don't really say with Ronaldo, but it was bizarre, yeah, to miss both of those chances. So that was perhaps a little bit concerning.
And your thoughts on Josef Font, especially I just didn't think he played particularly well in the Serbia match, and I was actually surprised that that Domingos Duarte didn't get the call again against Luxembourg. Not that they had a lot to do against Azerbaijan, but seemed to be playing relatively okay. I would say he wasn't spectacular against Azerbaijan. The defense didn't have to do much in that game, almost until the very end there, but. Given that it's, I understood him being called up against Serbia, a more physical team, but given the quality of the opponent in Luxembourg, and maybe that's me being a little disrespectful to the Luxembourg squad here, but I thought it was a opportunity for Domingos Duarte to once again, you know, because Fernand Sanchez has to figure out life after Pep, and we'll get to Pep in a second here, but or actually we could talk about it now. It was telling to me that the impact that a 38-year-old center back not being in a match, the impact was huge. And having to rely on someone of that age who in the last couple of years has gotten not huge knocks, but it's they're knocks that get him out for a few weeks here, a month there. You know, Father Time, as I've said this on many occasions, Father Time is undefeated, and at some point he's not going to be there. But there has to, Fernand Sanches, if there's anything, he needs to figure out who that guy, who the next guy is going to be, and sitting next to Ruben Dias. And as of right now, it's Domingos Duarte, and I thought it would have been a perfect opportunity for him to get another official cap on his under his belt to play with Ruben Dias against a team that may not have been as imposing physically as Serbia.
I agree. Yeah, no, and a word on Domingos Duarte. I thought that you're absolutely right. He was actually really good, I thought, against Azerbaijan. Again, you know, there wasn't a huge amount to do, but they threatened it a couple of moments, and there was one chance they had that he snuffed out in the six-yard box very well. He was very dominant in the air, and he was a bit of a threat in the attacking sense as well. So, yeah, I thought he was really accomplished, actually. I was really impressed with him, which is obviously a huge positive because he's a fair bit younger than Joseph Font as well. I mean, I understand why Joseph Font played, you know, the experience. He's been really good for Portugal over the years. But yes, you're absolutely right that it's concerning. It's concerning that we're going to lose Pep. It's not that far off now. We've known for a long time that the eventual retirement of Pep will hit Portugal extremely hard, arguably even harder than that of Ronaldo, but that's a discussion for another time. But yeah,
I don't know if you've heard Ronaldo is never going to retire.
Okay.
Never.
Oh, well, that's good.
He will be he'll always be in the starting 11 until he's 60 years old.
That's what we want to see. Yeah. Yeah. Why not? But I mean, yeah, Pep is going to be huge to replace. Absolutely. I don't think people really were giving him the credit that he deserved, perhaps. But he's just gone from strength to strength. And even at the age of 38, I think it is now. Yeah. He's proving a phenomenal defender still. And I think it's just that leadership as well that he has at the back and the partnership he has with Ruben Dias. It all works so well. Ultimately, I don't think he's irreplaceable. I think that there's going to be a bit of a transition phase. We haven't quite identified that player that's going to take over from him. But there are options out there. You know, Domingos Duarte has looked really good. José Font is a very short-term option as well. But we got the youngsters as well. We got late at Porto. We've got the two at Sporting, Inacio in particular. So we've got options there. None of them will probably be able to live up to what Pep's done. In fact, I would bet my money that they won't because he set the bar so high.
Absolutely.
But I don't think it's it. I think Portugal will be able to cope without him. It's not going to be perfect, but I think that we're blessed really in the sense that we have incredible depth in every position, and centre back is no longer the significant problem that it once was. I mean, we look back at Euro 2016. Where we took Bruno Alves, Pep, and Ricardo Carvalho as well, which is it's a little bit scary to look back at those times. We were really confused as to who would take over in defence at that point. But we finally seem to have some progression in that position, and so it's going to be a massive blow to lose Pep. But I think we will cope. We'll be able to cope without him, I'm sure.
Let's go to Ronaldo real quick, and you're listening to episode number 41 here of the Seleção Podcast. I'm your host, Danny Pinto. We're joined by Alex Gonçalves of Tuga Scout. You can follow Alex on Twitter at Al Jeeves. That's A-L-J-E-E-V-E-S. You can also follow Tuga Scout on Twitter as well, at Tuga Scout P-T. That's T-U-G-A-S-C-O-U-T-P-T. Alex also is contributing to Portugal.net, so you can read Alex everywhere, and make sure you follow him on Twitter and support him there, because he does a lot of great work covering Portuguese soccer and our beloved Seleção there. So let's get back to Ronaldo here. Obviously, he's on a mission to break that scoring record. He got number 103 against Luxembourg. Was robbed of his first chance at 103, I guess, in the Serbia game, and then scored another one where, if VAR in this instance was involved, he put that goal away in the second half, and you know, the ball was clearly in front of the defender, and with it, you know, just a whole bunch of things going on. He could have had two more goals. Let's just say that. But as you mentioned, and as anyone can really see, he did not have a great showing in these three matches. How much of it do you think is him pressing right now? How much of it do you think is him wanting that record? How much of it do you think is the struggles he's had with Juve this season, and how much of it do you think is him being 36 years old and playing a truncated schedule for the last six, seven months?
Yeah, no, they're all factors, surely. I mean, that you paint the picture, and it kind of makes sense as to why he was a little bit underwhelming, really, because that's a lot of things that were kind of working against him, be it now or just, you know, in terms of the schedule or just in terms of his age. There are many, many things affecting him, of course, and no one escapes aging, even Ronaldo, it seems. And he looked incredibly frustrated, I think, throughout all three games, really. He looked angrier than normal, and perhaps it's because he feels he isn't quite able to do what he once could, more so than in previous years. Of course, that's not to say that he's finished at the highest level. Far from it, you know. I think he might need to perhaps readapt to his capabilities again, which he's done so successfully in the past, and I'm sure he will, because he's that kind of player. He's got that determination and drive, and he'll realise what he needs to do to start finding the back of the net again, I'm sure. But I do think you're right. I think there is that element of that such strong desire to grab the record that he's almost pushing himself too much, and he's creating that pressure for himself. And it's difficult even for a player of his stature. It's gonna weigh on you when you can see that record in sight, but for one reason or another, it's just not quite happening for him. And I think we saw with the chances that he missed in previous years, he'd have tucked those away quite easily. So I think there is that element of pressure. There is, and I think he knows that the clock is not his friend at the moment. It's working against him a little bit because, of course, he's 36. I think he is now. So there is that pressure to try and get things done as quickly as possible. But I think that as you say, that there's the fact that he's played a lot of football this season. There's the fact that he's playing in a Juventus side that is also not particularly the best place to be at the moment. They're not hitting the expectations that people would have had of them. So there's a lot of things. Hopefully, all we need to hope for is that by the time Euro 2020 comes around, he'll be back in his goal scoring form that we're so used to seeing.
And I know this is a podcast; it isn't, you know, live action here. But you know, we've talked about how you know, maybe some respect needs to be given to these quote-unquote minnows, as maybe the dominating football of a team like Portugal or a team like England or a team like Germany against these lower level competition isn't as clear cut as it used to be, or you know, 6-7 goals shouldn't be the expectation. Alex, Germany just lost to North Macedonia 2-1.
So really, well, there you go. There you go. You see,
there's, so everybody relax.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think there is clearly that group of minnows still. You know, you've got the San Marinos and the Gibraltars and the Liechtensteins, I guess. But there is that bracket that used to be in that category that are improving slowly, you know, year on year. And I think we're seeing that. And that result in Germany is extraordinary. But again, that. You know, it does make it look better for Portugal. Ultimately, Portugal got the job done. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, as some might say.
Yeah, of course, the almighty Armenia leading that group right now.
On
3 wins in 3 matches, 9 points there. And of course, North Macedonia ahead of Germany because of not only goal differential but head to head. So just as it's supposed to be in the world of football, topsy turvy, that is for sure. Alex, what did you think of? I'll dub it. What did you think of Armband Gate?
I mean, I don't know if you'll agree, Danny, but I was very surprised by the reaction to his reaction, so to speak, you know, to his behavior. I, for one, didn't really take much notice of it. I thought that I wouldn't want him to react any differently, essentially. You know, that passion, that determination is what we've always associated with him, and it was what's arguably made him the greatest player in the world, arguably. You know, and ultimately, when that hunger's gone, the elite level Ronaldo that we know will be gone too. And I'm actually far more frustrated at the uproar and the overreaction to what Ronaldo did than I am with the incident itself and how Ronaldo reacted. So I think it's been more than excessive. It was a big deal made out of that. I think people are upset that he threw the armband on the floor. I mean, as if it's in some way disrespectful to his role or to his country. I mean, I don't know how anyone could really see it that way, because this is Ronaldo, you know. One thing we are blessed to have is a captain that is incredibly passionate for his country and representing his country. And he's always said that winning things with Portugal is what drives him the most. He says that winning Euro 2016 is the highlight of his career. So there was clearly no malice in it. It was obviously just anger and frustration, which I think was also felt by the nation. So I don't know how you feel about the situation, but I think it was just a big overreaction to the whole thing.
I think the optics of it doesn't look good just on the surface, just because, you know, it's I personally didn't care for him throwing the captain's armband on the ground, but I don't think he did it with any kind of like, I don't want to be captain of this team anymore, or, you know, to hell with this. This is, you know, sure, this is not what I want to do anymore. I don't think it was that. I think the optics of it just wasn't great. Weren't great, I should say. But I think it's already forgotten. But I felt like I needed to bring it up, just because I'm sure there are people like yourself who don't think the, or who think the a bigger deal was made of it, and I kind of fall in that category as well. But I wouldn't be true to myself as someone who you know loves his team to say that it didn't look great, and I didn't think it was a proper way for a captain to react. But I think it was just a one and done situation, and you know the questions that Fernand Santos had to take, or the fact that he even had to speak on, is he still going to be the captain? I mean, who else is going to be the captain right now? I mean, I love Ruben Dias, and I think he's going to be the next one in line and should be, but I don't think it was a take the captain's armband fireable offense. I just think it was a guy who was frustrated, who clearly was right to be frustrated because of the goal not being scored or not being counted, and a lot of pent up frustration that I'm sure he's had with his play and for both club and country. I mean, he was coming off of what, 4.5 games before he scored his last goal for the Seleção. So he hasn't had the greatest run here, but frustrating. Yeah. Not a good look. Yeah. Is it done? I say 100%, because he wore the armband against Luxembourg.
Yes, and I mean, I think ultimately, I think it seems that the majority are quite upset with him throwing the armband on the floor. It does seem. I think I'm perhaps in the minority on that front. But I think Tom Kunde put it quite well. Essentially Ronaldo was going to throw anything that he had to hand on the ground. You know, it didn't matter what he had, whatever it was going on the floor. And I think that sums it up. It was. I agree. I do see your point. It doesn't look great. You know, it's not what we want to see. And he's always held himself to a high standard when captaining Portugal. But ultimately, I think that it was just a case of that incredible frustration. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's ideally it wouldn't happen. Ideally, he would be able to contain his frustration a little bit more. But ultimately, if I were in that position, I think that I probably would have reacted in a very similar way.
We're talking with Alex Gonçalves here on episode number 41 of the Seleção podcast. Alex, a question for you, but something that just came to me here, and we'll talk about player, and we'll continue our talk with players here, but we'll put Ronaldo to bed. He's the greatest. He's fine. You know what? I'll come back to him after this question, because I don't want to lose my train of thought here, but mm-hmm. How much do you think the revolving door that was the midfield in these three matches had to do with maybe the lack of cohesion and the lack of fluidity in the offense for the Seleção?
That's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it too much either, but it's, it can't be easy to play in a team that is constantly changing its midfield. And it did change its midfield a lot. I think one thing we could say is that, William Carvalho was a big miss. I think we all agree that he should have been left out of the team and left out of the squad, because ultimately all five of the, or all six, I can't remember how many midfielders there were, but however many there were, they all deserve to be ahead of him because his club form's not been the best. But I think it was notable that a lot of what Portugal have done with Fernando Santos in charge has come through William Carvalho in midfield. So I think his absence was kind of felt. And I think that also Fernando Santos seemed to struggle a little bit to kind of come up with a solution to his absence, really. There was a lot of chopping and changing in midfield. Ultimately, I would have liked to have seen Sergio Oliveira play a little bit more. I think he's had a quality season. And of course, I'd have liked to have seen João Palhinha play a fair bit more as well, because he's been phenomenal. And only three substitute appearances was a little bit harsh, I thought. I think that's probably Fernando Santos's big problem at the moment. I think defence is pretty much secure. I think he knows his best back line. He knows his best goalkeeper. Midfield is another question entirely. I don't think he is entirely sure on the best trio or the best the best two to play in midfield. I think that's the big problem he faces now. Who's going to make up that midfield? But yeah, the disjointed performances could certainly be put down to the fact that there was a lot of chopping and changing in midfield.
I felt that it was a bit disjointed, and obviously you look at the second half of the Serbia match, the first half of the Luxembourg match. You know, the Azerbaijan match is such an anomaly, because I think that those amount of shots, the amount of corners, it goes back to, I forget if it was the Ukraine match or the Serbia match in Euro qualifying, where Portugal did everything but score in those matches. it took a Danilo bomb against Serbia to have the Slesong on the board in those two matches of Euro qualifying, but they were getting the attack was there, it just wasn't being they weren't converting. The second half of Serbia and the first half of Luxembourg, that's where the disjointedness and just lack of fluidity and creativity just was so on display. And I felt that in watching both those matches, I felt that as I termed it, the revolving door of the midfield could have played a part in that. I mean, again, Fernando Sanches is also in a spot where, you know, João Moutinho played in the first match, was not available the last two matches. Danilo didn't play the first match, got injured in the second match, and then wasn't available for the Luxembourg match. You have João Palhinha, who's making his debut. Who knows how he's going to be as a Seleção player. The reintroduction of Renato Sanches. A lot of moving parts here. That's to say, that could, to me, could have also played a role in the disjointedness of the attack for Portugal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I agree entirely. I don't know if it is a case, because as you say, that he was forced to make quite a few changes as well. This wasn't just a case of him chopping and changing.
Sure, absolutely.
There was quite a bit of forced, changes in the lineup. But I do think overall he's still not. I mean, I can't tell you what Portugal's strongest midfield is. I couldn't tell you who I'd like to see start. If we were to have a midfield three, for example, does Bernardo Silva play in midfield, in central midfield? Does Danilo start ahead of Ruben Neves, or does João Palhinha start? Should William Carvalho come back in? Renato Sanches, should he start? And then we've got Bruno Fernandes as well. There is a massive puzzle there for Fernando Sanches to solve. And it's a great puzzle to have, but ultimately it's going to be the difference between Portugal potentially winning this Euros or falling short. It's gonna be fine margins like that. So I don't envy him at all. but we're blessed to have such quality in every department. It's spectacular. Yeah.
Yeah. Bruno Fernandes missing out on Luxembourg based on yellow card accumulation there as well. So. The midfield thing just caught my eye there during the matches, and it was something that came to me mid-interview here. But one last thing on Ronaldo. Is it fair to him when he's playing as many minutes as he is, and is it fair to him, especially when it became 3-1, and I know it became 3-1 late, but instead of taking out Bernard Silva and Diogo Jota, Jota's obviously playing well. I thought Bernard Silva had a pretty decent match against Luxembourg. I know Fernand Sanch would be murdered if he takes out Ronaldo and then it's a draw or they somehow lose. But and murdered in the media, not, you know, not physically. Everyone just relax. But I believe I believe Cristiano Ronaldo and Ruben Dias were the only on-field players outside of obviously Anthony Lopes, who played every minute of the three matches. That has to be taken into consideration at some point, don't you think, to have him subbed off, if especially if he's not being effective?
Yes.
Now, well, I not to interrupt your answer, because I wanted to get the yes first, because what I wanted to say was what you said earlier in the previous question was, I don't envy him if he has to do that.
It's a massive call, isn't it? Because as you say, if you take off Ronaldo at 2-1 and you end up drawing 2-2, that is that's what's going to be in the headlines. Ultimately, though, that is his job. He's got to make these big decisions. That is why he's the manager of Portugal. And even if I would assume the only reason Ronaldo played all 270 minutes or whatever it was is because he said he wanted to. I think if Fernando Sanches could choose, he would have said, look, I want to take you off at 60, 65 minutes if we're winning by this scoreline or whatever. Although, actually, Portugal were never in a comfortable position at around 60, 65 minutes. So it's difficult to know whether that was in the conversation or not. But yeah, I think that the idea that Ronaldo's place is completely secure, regardless of how he's playing on the field, is something that really should, serious questions should be asked of, because as you said, Diogo Jota was playing really well. He was taken off. And nobody is bigger than the country. Even Ronaldo is not bigger than Portugal. So we've got to, sometimes you've got to be willing to make those decisions if you're Fernando Santos. That's why he's paid the big bucks. That's why he is the coach of the Seleção. So I completely agree. Yeah, I don't think that he should be at this stage in his career immune to substitution, because that also is a bad thing for him, because it means that he knows when he's having a bad game, there's no pressure on him, because he's going to finish the match if he wants to. So I think it would motivate him more. I think that it would bring the best out of it. I think it would bring the best out of Portugal if there was that willingness to change things up and upset the apple cart at those moments. And I think that it has to be done. I think that's a serious question that needs to be addressed moving forward. Yeah.
One of the players we mentioned in that lead up here was Diogo Jota. Obviously, another great spell for him with the national team. 3 goals in 2 starts. In the last two matches for the Seleção that he has been called up for, the last two matches in which he did not get the start, it was the 1-0 loss to France in the Nations League, which ultimately knocked Portugal out of contention to repeat, or for a chance to repeat, I should say, as Nations League champions. And then the 1-0 victory against Azerbaijan, where an own goal was the manner in which wow. Portugal won.
Yeah.
He's got 5 starts under his belt, 6 goals and an assist as a member of the Seleção when he starts. There is no reason going forward why Diogo Jota would not be in the starting 11, right?
No reason whatsoever. No, I think that he should certainly be the one of, if not the very first name on the team sheet. It's interesting because at times he doesn't seem to have a particularly amazing game, but ultimately when you're putting the ball in the back of the net, that's all that matters. And He came up good. He got 3 goals, all headers, and that's what we expect from Ronaldo, really, isn't it? That's why we start the legend himself. We expect him to be in the position to finish those off. Diogo Jota is the one that's doing it at the moment, and as long as he's scoring, he should absolutely be in the starting 11, and that's an impressive thing, because there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of competition for places, but he has earned the right to be an indisputable starter, I think. Yes.
A player who was in the starting lineup last night, or as of this recording last night, but João Félix went off midway through the, or almost towards the end of the first half. Seemed like he picked up a knock right outside the 18, about midway through the first half. Mm. But he was a topic of conversation for Fernand Sanch after the Luxembourg match. Obviously, Fernand Sanch recognizes the skill that João Félix brings to the table, but that it just hasn't translated to the Seleção as of yet. What did you think of his comments about João Félix, and what do you think of Félix's role and standing currently right now with this national team?
Well, I think that it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because he is clearly, as Fernand Sanch pointed out, he's a very skillful player. And I think that there is that element of combativeness with Félix. I think that he's benefited from playing for Atletico Madrid, of course. I think that's improved that part of his game, and he's shown at club level that he's able to contribute to the defensive aspect of the game when necessary, put a shift in for the team. But at the same time, I do think that Neto perhaps does offer more defensive presence. He does work harder off the ball perhaps than Félix. So I see the point that was being made. Ultimately, it's difficult. It's going to be difficult for Félix to earn a starting place, as it is for all of the attacking stars, because there's such a wealth of options available to Fernand Sanch that no one really, except Ronaldo, is a guaranteed starter. Even Diogo Jota is going to have to maintain good form to be able to maintain his place in the starting 11, because ultimately, you know, we saw Pedro Gonçalves. She missed out on this competition, on these qualifiers. And there is absolutely no reason why he couldn't be included in Portugal's squad moving forward. He's had an unbelievable season for Sporting. And same with Trincão. What if he goes on and has an absolute rampage at the end of the season for Barcelona? Then suddenly we've got two more players that weren't even in the squad suddenly fighting for a starting place for Portugal. So it's interesting, I think, because from what we can see, it seems whoever comes off the bench does better than whoever starts. I don't think Pedro Neto was amazing when he started, and I thought João Félix, when he came on against Azerbaijan, was great.
Agreed.
I thought he had a huge impact on the game. Yeah. And then the other way around, against Luxembourg, where João Félix started, he was not very effective. Pedro Neto comes off from the bench, and suddenly he gets two assists and he changes the game for Portugal. So that's a conundrum. You know, do you start rewarding players who do well off the bench with the starting players, or do you realise that actually maybe they're just better off the bench? You save them, and then if you need them later, you can bring them on. Because ultimately, neither of them really took their chance when they started, but they both took their chance when they came off the bench. So it's a conundrum. It's another conundrum.
We're talking with Alex Gonçalves here of Tuga Scout PT. You can follow Alex on Twitter here at Al Jeeves. That's A-L-J-E-E-V-E-S. And then on Twitter as well for Tuga Scout, at Tuga Scout PT. TugaScout.com is the website. Alex, so we have three matches. They're set in first place after these three qualifiers. Our attention now focuses towards hopefully a injury-free schedule or a club schedule the rest of the way, and then two friendlies in June before the Euro 2020 and Euro 20 or the Euro defense, I should say. What is it that you see with this team right now that Fernand Sanch needs to focus on finding and focus on improving in order for them to defend, at least give themselves a fighter's chance of defending their European title?
Well, I think firstly, Portugal are already in a better place to win this competition than they were heading into Euro 2016. I think
100%, absolutely.
That bodes well, you know. Already off from the off, Portugal, regardless of form, are in a very good position. But I think that to increase those chances of defending the crown, first of all, need to find a settled best team. And I think you referred to it really well with the revolving midfield. If we can crack the best midfield for certain games, obviously it's going to change, you know, depending on the opposition, it should change. You've got to have that flexibility. But I think there's got to be a little bit more consistency and a bit more balance. I think that's another thing. We can't fall into the trap that could easily happen seeing a lot of attacking quality, but ultimately, if there isn't space to start them all, that we can't shoehorn them in just for the sake of it. There's got to be balance to the team. So that's the main thing, I think, finding the balance, finding the best team, and figure out a concrete style of how to play the bigger teams. You know, this break didn't go very well. It didn't really teach us a lot, I don't think, because ultimately Portugal dominated two of the matches in terms of possession. They were tasked with breaking the sides down, but that's going to be extremely different in the Euros, particularly in the group stage where we have three very difficult games. And it's going to be far more expansive, much more open. And so we need to have a clear game plan for how we're going to approach playing the biggest sides, because we haven't done that for a while now. It feels like a long time, certainly. So that's the main thing, I think.
You know, let's end on a bit more positive note here. And Alex, I can't thank you enough for giving us so much of your time for this episode here. But Euro 2021 under 21s. I'll say that perfectly at some point in my life, but the under 21 European Championship, there it is, has started off like gangbusters for Rui Jorge and his Esperanças, which I think is such a cool nickname for this group of players. Portugal in Group D, they go 3-for-3, 3 wins, 0 losses, 0 draws. No goals suffered at all. They go 6 goals, and they beat Croatia, England, and Switzerland in that order, 1-0, 2-0, and 3-0. Obviously, there's a pipeline of talent, as we talked about earlier, with, you know, players like Trincão and Pedro Gonçalves, and center backs like Diogo Leite, who may be called upon at some point in his to a senior career. That'll begin probably sooner rather than later. But you know, just a quick thought on the Esperanças, and the funny thing about this tournament is that, yeah, the group play is done now, but they don't play until now until the 31st of May in the knockouts in the quarterfinals, where they take on Italy. But just maybe a quick note on your thoughts on the under 21s.
Very impressive. Yeah, it's very good to see. That's a tough group on paper. Croatia, England, and Switzerland. But easy work made of it from the young Portuguese. Fabio Veiga looks like he's having a quality season, a quality campaign, I should say. Vitinha as well, of Wolves, he's doing very well. A lot of quality in that team, though. You look at the teams that they all play for as well. They're in and around the first team of some very reputable European outfits. So it's very strong. It's a strong side. There's a lot of quality there. A few of them could do a good job for the senior side, certainly. And it's very encouraging. Yeah, because you know, I've been a little bit concerned with some of the performances of the under 21s previously, but this tournament, they seem to be going from strength to strength. You know, 1-0, 2-0, 3-0. It's very positive. Of course, with a long break until they continue, anything can happen between now and then. But yeah, it's quite incredible that Portugal seems to have strength at every level at this point. So the future is very bright as well as the present. So I'm excited. I'm very excited to see how they do with that.
You know, I don't envy Rui Jorge and his decision making here. Towards the end of May, because as we both know, he does have a couple of players who have some senior experience, or could make that next step very quickly to the senior squad. And with the, well, you know what, you would have to think that, and again, I'd have to look this up, but you would have to think that their inclusion now, if they were called up for this tournament, they can't switch out any players in May.
It's a very good point, yeah.
Because I was going was, you know, what if Trincão, what if Fernando Santos wants to call up Trincão for the Euros? What if he wants to give Pedro Gonçalves that cap or that run in the Euros? What if, you know, injuries hit and we have to go to a guy like Diogo Leite to play center back? That'll be interesting to see how that comes about, because I'm just wondering, because of the gap, if they have to call up the same team, that'd be interesting.
That's very interesting because, of course, also you could have injuries to your under 21 players as well. So
yeah,
they may
absolutely
need to be replaced. Is that allowed? You know, so yeah, that's a very good question. I hadn't really thought about it, but I wonder, yeah, if they're locked in or if it can change. That's a it's an unusual situation, I guess. It's unprecedented. But I'd have to look that one up. That's quite interesting. Yes.
And see, I put you on the spot, Alex, and I apologize for that. It just came to me as we were talking about it. I'm like, yeah, well,
it's a very good point.
The knockouts are at the end of May. The tournament or Euro 2020 starts in the middle of June. I'm just wondering if that's even possible. But Alex, I've taken up way too much of your time. So glad you were able to join us and talk about these World Cup qualifiers.
Being fantastic,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a blast to have you back on, and can't thank you enough for all the support you give the pod. And remember, again, follow Alex on Twitter at Al Jeeves. That's AljeeVes. Follow Tuga Scout on Twitter as well at Tuga Scout PT. And of course, TugaScout.com. Also check out his great work and writing and contributing over at Portugal.net. Glad we can collaborate somehow on that side and also on this podcast, Alex. And we can't wait to have you back on.
I really look forward to it. Thank you very much for having me.
And our thanks once again to Alex Gonçalves of TugaScout.com for joining us on episode number 41 of the Seleção podcast. There was a lot to cover there from the team, from the players, from Fernando Santos, struggles. Why does it happen? Why was there no VAR? We covered it all, and I hope that you guys enjoyed the conversation. Alex is always a pleasure to speak with, and I hope you guys give him some love on Twitter. Follow him on Twitter at Al Jeeves. That's AljeeVes, and also follow Tuga Scout on Twitter as well at Tuga Scout PT. Let him know that you heard him on the Seleção podcast, and that he did an absolutely phenomenal job there. So that will do it for the Seleção podcast, episode number 41. I did want to leave you guys with this. Obviously, there was a lot of discussion, and we discussed it, I should say, on this episode regarding the armband. And you know, I gave my thought on you know, I didn't particularly care for Ronaldo throwing the armband away. Or not throwing it away, but throwing it on the ground following the Serbia match. Obviously, he was frustrated. I get that, but as a captain, I didn't care for that being the response to a tough situation. But with that said, some positive news to come out of that. The captain armband that he threw on the ground at the end of that match is being auctioned off for a very good cause. This is according to Bleacher Report. Their Twitter account at BR Football. So again, 2-2, the goal is denied. He's pissed. Obviously, Ronaldo is. At the end of the match, it ends as a draw, and he throws the armband away. A charity group somehow got the armband from a stadium worker in Serbia who picked it up from picked it up off the ground after the match, and it's now being auctioned off to raise money for the surgery of a six-month-old Serbian boy with spinal muscular atrophy. So, obviously not the way we want to see Ronaldo respond to a controversial call or non-call his dissatisfaction with a call. But if there's any good that can come from that, is hopefully that there's going to be a lot of money raised in this auction for this six-month-old Serbian boy who unfortunately is dealing with spinal muscular atrophy. So our thoughts and prayers are with the young baby, his family, and the doctors, that everything goes well for the young child, and that he will be okay. So we want to definitely end with some positive news that came from what I called armband gate. So again, our thanks to Alex Gonçalves for joining us on episode number 41 of the Seleção podcast. Again, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at Seleção Pod. Check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/SeleçãoPod. Email the show, SeleçãoPod@gmail.com. Check out the new site, SeleçãoPod.com. It has been redesigned. It is pretty much awesome now, so that's good. But go ahead and check out the site. Let us know your thoughts. Again, subscribe and rate, review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you are subscribing to us. If you can give us any kind of review and some positive words, we would greatly appreciate that. So my name is Danny Pinto. I have been your host of episode number 41 of the Seleção Podcast, a proud partner of Portugal.net. And as always, Força Portugal!